Is there a war on America as founded? How well are our schools teaching American history? Is there such a thing as American exceptionalism? Author Jane Hampton Cook has written several books on our nation's history. On our website, janecook.com, she writes, quote, only 13% of 8th grade students are proficient in American history. A way to address this problem is to incorporate historical stories from the American Revolution into other subjects, such as adding novels and books about the American Revolution into American literature courses. End quote from Jane Hampton Cook, author of such books as Stories of Faith and Courage from the Revolutionary War and The Faith of America's First Ladies. She joins us now to discuss The War on America as Founded, the war on American history, and better ways in which we can get people interested in this very, very important subject. I'm Dr. Jerry Newcomb, the Executive Director of Providence Forum, and we welcome Jane Cook back to the program. Jane, are you there?
I am here.
Okay, good, good. Well, thank you so much for joining us. First, let's begin with the problem itself. Apparently, a lot of young people today don't really know much about American history, or maybe what they do know is wrong, and it's almost like it's all a negative picture.
Yes, and so that statistic, the 13% of eighth graders, only 13% are proficient in American history, comes from the U.S. Department of Education. It came out last year in 2023, and it is a problem. I mean, you see even things like there was a school in California, and their mascot was the Minutemen, and they decided to change it because they didn't think their minority students could relate to the Minutemen. But the truth is, there were black men who were Minutemen. Peter Salem was one of them. He fought at the Battle of Concord and then spent 6 years in the Continental Army. And so, you know, there's even, like you said, even what they are taught isn't necessarily accurate and the truth. And so I think it's really important that we start to find ways to shift that tide and help people fall in love with America again.
It really is actually a very fascinating story, and I think one of the parts that's often left out is the faith factor.
Yes, the faith factor is often left out, and it's a very important part of the culture of the 1700s. And you know, the founders, that generation of Americans, they really understood and they saw God as providence. You see that term used a lot by George Washington and others. It's in the Declaration of Independence. And providence, defined by a minister of the time period, meant God's presence. And so that's what providence meant to them. And they really saw God's hand as being involved in the founding of our nation through, you know, different events that happened in the American Revolution. They thought it was miraculous, for example, that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson died on the same day, and it happened to be the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. And so even in newspapers who covered that event back then, you have the mayor of New York talking about how that was a providential happening, that Jefferson and Adams died on the same day. And so when you leave faith out of it, you miss a big part of the humanity of the story.
Now, that's interesting to me that you've actually written a book about America's first ladies, but in, you know, particularly their faith. A lot of times, I mean, I know it sounds like a cliche, but the idea of the, you know, behind every successful man, there's a, you know, a very important woman, you know, often behind the scenes. People, I know that's often poo-pooed today because of feminism and so forth, but there's a reality to it. And so please tell us, why did you decide to even write about that? And what did you find in your research? I know, for example, that George loved Martha Washington so much, and she, you know, encouraged him when things were very difficult, and things were often very difficult for him.
Yes, they were. And in the case of Martha and George Washington, Martha was with George during about 50% of the war. And I think it's easy to think that she just, you know, stayed behind at Mount Vernon and waited it out. But she didn't. She was with him when they were in winter camp and when they weren't in the fighting season. And she was there to help, you know, encourage him, help encourage the officers, and to give them, you know, they used their winter time to plan and to rebuild. And the women, there was, you know, there were relationships behind these couples that John Adams wrote Abigail that he wanted to watch her think. He missed her so much that he just wanted to be around her while she was thinking, you know, and that was a true partnership that I think we can relate to our founders better when we think of them in those human terms, in those relational terms. And that's certainly what, you know, the first ladies, many of them were able to do, is influence, you know, their husbands and their sons and their brothers through those relationships that were so important.
I know in the case of Jefferson, his wife died pretty young, and that was a devastating blow.
Yes.
I believe 1892, and then passing on or moving on to Madison. Didn't he marry relatively late? But James and Dolly Madison had quite a relationship. But if there's anything else you want to add about Jefferson, feel free.
Sure. Well, you know, I really think that, you know, Jefferson, I'm not sure he ever really got over the death of his wife. I think that influenced him very deeply on a very deep, you know, emotional level. And then, yes, you're correct. James Madison married later in life, but he married a woman, Dolly Madison, who was 17 years younger than he was. And they were a pair of opposites. You know, she was sociable and outgoing, and she came from the Quaker tradition of being anti-war, and yet he was this introvert who became a wartime president. And so there's a contradiction there that she had to deal with, what her faith had taught her about war and what, you know, she was living through as the wife of the president. And I think it's because of that we even have the term First Lady, because after the White House was burned by the British military during the War of 1812, Dolly decides to start a charity for orphans. And she was the first wife of a president to ever engage in public service like that. Before that, the women had confined themselves to a hostess kind of role. And she broke that mold, and she made it acceptable for the wife of the president to engage in charity and doing good for others. And that's why she was called the First Lady of the land at her funeral. And that's where we get the term First Lady. And, you know, their relationship was something that meant a lot to both of them, and they drew strength from each other, you know, during that difficult time in our nation's history. So and I've written a screenplay about that called Saving Washington. And so I've actually got somebody looking at it right now. So trying to get the word out through film, because people do digest stories through film in our culture. So
yeah,
we'd love to see that one become.
That's very true. And, you know, we started out this discussion just mentioning how there is a lack of interest in American history, which is really quite unfortunate. Okay, you mentioned the burning down of the White House in 1814. That was in August, I believe. Okay, well, within a few days, the British, after attacking Washington, D.C., which is really pretty not much of a city at the time, okay, and they burned down the Capitol, they burned down the White House. Then they go on to a plush city nearby that is Baltimore, but they're blocked in the harbor by this fort, Fort McHenry. And it was there, you know, within a week or two that the incident that spawned our national anthem was, you know, that incident occurred. And you know, it grows out of it, really, in effect, the burning down of Washington, D.C. You know, they're moving on to the next city, the bigger one, the Baltimore. Yeah. It's beautiful. And, you know, but today the national anthem is poo-pooed and, you know, looked down upon and all this kind of stuff. But if people could only realize the stories behind these things, they realize, oh, no, this is very interesting. This is not worth jettisoning.
Exactly. And, you know, we have a lot of political animosity in our culture, and Francis Scott Key was a Georgetown lawyer, and he opposed Madison's War of 1812. But after the Capitol was burned by the British and the White House, he went to Madison. He put aside his political differences, and he went to President Madison and said, "May I have a flag of truce so I can go to the British and rescue an American doctor who's been taken captive?" And Madison granted that to him. And then that's how he came about being in the harbor, watching from the British side the bombing of Fort McHenry, and then the next morning seeing this giant flag flying to signify that the Americans had held the day. and that he was so overcome with emotion, and that was his 9/11. The burning of the White House, the Battle of Bladensburg, and the burning of the Capitol was Francis Scott Key's 9/11, and that's why he wrote the what had happened in what we now call the Star Spangled Banner, and that poetry came out of that heartache and then the joy of realizing we had survived and that we were going to survive as a country and not go back to being part of Great Britain.
So what do we need to do to kind of train a whole new generation of American young people to realize, hey, come on, folks, don't give up something that you don't even know what it is. And people risk their lives to even try and come here to America to enjoy the freedoms we enjoy because of the sacrifices of some of the people we've been talking about.
I think there's a few things we need to do. I think we need to, we talked a little bit about film. I think we need to see more American history films made. And there's a new...
Can I be honest with you, though, real fast? I would almost rather not see a new film made if they're going to make it, you know, the way Hollywood often makes it, you know, where, you know, or every, you know, every white person is
Michigan,
bad and, you know, whatever, you know.
There's a Michigan-based filmmaker who wants to do... films about American history in the vein that we're discussing. So he's very much on board of trying to get rid of some of the gunk that comes out of Hollywood and instead present some really great heroic stories. And so his company is called America Studios. There's a new movie coming out called The American Miracle, and it's going to be out in 2025. And that would be a great one for people to see because it shows you the hand of God in his intervening for America during the American Revolution. But I also just think we need more children's books in the market. There, I noticed that there's a whole genre of children's books that don't even have patriotic versions of them. They're called Steps into Reading, and they're numbered 1, 2, 3, 4 for a young child to learn how to read. And so I've been writing some patriotic books in that style that I'm going to get out into the marketplace in May. About the American flag, about the Pledge of Allegiance, and My Country, 'Tis of Thee. And so also I think if our schools could start combining, when they teach writing, they can also teach history. There's a curriculum called Institute for Excellence in Writing that does that. They have samples of writing samples that are all from American history. So those are the kinds of things that we can do, and as well as, you know, trying to incorporate novels about the Revolution into American literature classes. I think people learn through story. That's why films have been successful, you know, in teaching, in telling stories, is people want to see a great story. And you're right, we need to make sure that films elevate the best in a story and not some of the other things that sometimes come out of Hollywood.
Well, and I think the faith factor is often what is missing. Partly it's because the worldview of the filmmaker is such that means nothing to them, and so why should they, you know, say? But if you look at George Washington, I mean, he said on numerous occasions, you know, you must be worse than an infidel if you're not grateful to God for the liberties that we enjoy in America. It seems as if every step along the way, God and his providence, you know, has helped us through this, you know, one crisis after another.
President, he reminded Americans immediately, you know, in his inaugural address, that of the humility that he had before God, that because of the interpositions of providence, you know, that we were successful in the American Revolution, and then we were successful in the battle that they had, the mental battle over the Constitution. And he encouraged Americans to set aside a day of giving thanks. That's one thing I've noticed, is that during that founding era, there were multiple times when people decided to set aside a day for giving thanks to God. Sometimes it was under great conditions, and sometimes it was under difficult conditions. But it was that humility that life is not just about me, you know, that it's about a higher power. It's about God.
Okay.
Loves us and cares for us.
And we're out of time, but thank you so much. JaneCook.com. JaneCook.com. Thank you, Jane. All the best.